My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Qualified briefly. I qualified for a long, long time. I could. When it was time to stop drinking, I couldn't stop drinking. And then when it got to where I wanted to stop drinking, I couldn't stop drinking. And then I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stopped drinking. And that's, that qualifies. I've been sober for more than a year. It qualifies me to be up here. And then I'm going to have Ray introduce the speaker, and then there's more announcements.
Everybody, my name is Ray Johnson. I am an alcoholic. I have the honor and the privilege of introducing our speaker today. I've known this guy for a few years, and I can always count on words of recovery coming from him regardless of the situation that he finds himself in. And it's encouraging to me because I need that in my life. I need people around me that show that kind of recovery when the times are hard and the chips are down. I remember one night we were standing outside of Central after a meeting, and I don't know how the conversation got there, but Angel started talking to me about cleaning his house. I'm like, cleaning his house? What the hell has that got to do with anything? He says, well, you know, if I don't take care of what I got, why would God see fit to give me anything more? And it's the little things like that that you remember from people that you really care about. So, everybody else, this is Angel.
Dang! A lot of y'all. My name's Angel. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 13, 1988, and that's only by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would truly not be here or be the person I am if it wasn't for AA and the 12 steps, and for that I'm eternally grateful. My home group is the Central Group of Orlando, Florida, the best damn group in the world. And like my sponsor used to say, and I, now that he's gone, I say it for him, everybody should feel that their group is the best group in the world. And if you don't feel that way about your group, please don't come to mine and mess mine up. Stay here. Stay at yours and make yours better. And as my sponsor also used to say, he said, Angel, you got to get drunk and undrunk real quick here when you speak. And so that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm supposed to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in 1957. If you have problems adding math or whatever else you got to do, I'm 22 years old. Whatever. I was born to, first of all, let me tell you my complete name so we'll rule out all controversies. My full name is Angelo Machiavello. I'm supposed to be Puerto Rican, born in Brooklyn in a Jewish hospital with an Italian name. So I was mixed up in the giddy-up. My parents, my grandfather was born in Italy, migrated to Puerto Rico. My mother was born in Puerto Rico. My dad was born in Puerto Rico. And then I was born in Brooklyn. And I thought I had it bad until my little brother was born. He was born in the same hospital I was on St. Patrick's Day, so he really got it. He really got screwed on that one. My parents came to this country to try to make a better life for their children. And my dad caught asthma at a long time, as soon as he came into the United States, to the point where he couldn't work. So I was raised, one of eight kids, raised on welfare in the hood in Brooklyn. My parents, you know, were good Christian folks. They were the Hispanic Pentecostals that believed in the girls shouldn't wear pants, they shouldn't wear jewelry, they couldn't wear makeup, they had to go to church at least three times a week, sometimes seven, because if you weren't behaving, you had to go seven times a week so they could rebuke the demons out of you. So I went to church seven times a week because that was a little troublemaker from the get-go. I rebelled against the church and against God at an early age. I thought that this God thing was crappy because my dad and my mom would go to church and praise God and glory to God and all this good stuff. And then you turn around and get home, and for something you did, you would get your butt whipped. So I couldn't understand where this all love and God thing came into effect when they got home and beat us the way they did. I understand now, and I don't blame my parents for what they did. They did the best they could with what they knew. I also understand that they were orphaned at an early age. Both of them were orphaned before they were teenagers, and they didn't have no parenting skills. I understand that. And I'm an alcoholic because I like the effects produced by alcohol, like it says in the big book, not because of something my parents did. Because God knows if I had a child like me, I would have beat his butt too. I started getting in trouble at a ripe old early age of 12 when I first picked up my first drink. See, because when I was a kid, I never seemed to fit anywhere. I grew up in a poor neighborhood in Brooklyn, and it was a mixed neighborhood. We had the white kids, the black kids, the Hispanic kids, and I would go and try to hang out with the white kids, and they would tell me, get out of here, you don't belong here. Then I go try to hang out with the little black kids, and they say, get out of here, you don't belong here. So then I try to hang out with the Puerto Rican kids, and they tell me, get out of here, you don't belong here. It didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. It didn't feel in like when I went to school for the first grade. I remember the first day of school, I went there and I looked around, and everybody seemed like they belonged there except me. Somehow I felt I didn't belong there. And I remember that caused me to play hooky in the first grade. And in my mother's church, I remember thinking as a kid growing up, why couldn't we have been born Catholic? This is before I had a drink. I remember thinking, why can't we be born Catholic? At least they could drink, smoke, and dance. Because we couldn't do none of that. And everything was a sin in my mother's church, you know. If you disobeyed your parents, sin. If you stole candy, sin. You know, for all the things I'd done up to that point without drinking, I was going to hell anyway. So, you know. And I remember playing hooky, and that was a sin that was disrespecting my parents in first grade. Then I got hungry, and I've always been a skinny guy, but some of y'all who know me know how well I can eat. And I used to eat even better before I started drinking. And I got hungry around lunchtime and went and stole some oranges that day from the Fifth Avenue produce stands. So that was sin number two. And then I was always intrigued by why people smoked cigarettes and all that, because we couldn't do it. And I'm hanging out by a corner, and I saw this old guy coming down with a cigar, and he's smoking it. And he threw half of the cigar into the sidewalk. And, you know, you're in first grade. You're a little kid. You don't know what you're doing. So I wanted to see what this big deal about smoking was. And I picked up that cigar. And it was one of these old guys who smashes the cigar in the end real bad. And I took one drag of that and drank half of that stuff down. And I, to this day, I can't stand cigars, you know. And but that was sin number three. So I couldn't tell my parents all this. So I knew I was going to hell from that point on. At the age of 12, I was walking through a schoolyard, and some of the fellows were hanging out, and they were drinking some beers, and they were smoking these funny cigarettes, and I'm also what was known as a compulsive liar. I mean, not to the point where I lie about everything, but to a point where if you ask me, have I ever done something, not only have I done it before, but I did it better than anybody else can, you know, and I remember... remember being raised Pentecostal that, you know, we had no drink, no drugs in our house, nothing. I never saw my dad drink. But they were drinking and smoking these funny cigarettes, and one of them passed me one of those funny cigarettes and said, Angel, you ever try this? Oh, yeah, we have it in the house. We go out in the basement. Yeah, I've heard it hundreds of times, you know. So I took a toke of that funny cigarette, and I... then they passed me this beer, and I started drinking that beer. And I don't know how to explain it, but when it gets down to your stomach, and then you start feeling this all of a sudden this feeling of warmth come up through your body, and then the sudden explosion in your head, and I found what I was looking for my whole life. See, until that point, I didn't fit in. I was skinny, scroungy, ugly little kid. But the minute that alcohol started taking effect, I mean, my face started getting better looking. I started growing muscles everywhere. I had the body of Arnold Schwarzenegger and the face of John Travolta right there in the schoolyard. And I commenced to hit on every little girl who walked by the schoolyard. And from that point on, I drank alcoholically. And what I mean by that was I was to chase that for the rest of my life until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was to chase that feeling for a long time. And it didn't matter what got in my way. Wives, kids, parents, nothing mattered but me chasing that drink. started causing me a lot of trouble. By the time I was, and I'm not going to get into a big drunk log because I'm here to try to basically talk about the solution to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm going to touch on a couple of things. Like, at the ripe age of 15, the Juvenile Department of Justice in Brooklyn, the judge, my court-appointed pretender, my public pretender, my probation officer, they all got together and decided that I needed to be locked up before I reached 16, because if I reached 16, I was going to be sent to a jail. So they sent me to one of the finest gated communities for young boys in New York, in upstate New York, for 18 months. It was called Lincoln Hall. It was a reformatory for boys under the age of, from the age of like 12 to like 21. And where I learned how to craft some of my finer behaviors I was to use later on down the road. When I got out of reform school, and I need y'all to hear this part because this is very, very important. I was 17 years old, and that was the peak of my life. That was the best my life had ever been when I creeped out of that reform school after doing 18 months. I hit the streets of Brooklyn, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to go join the Army. You know, they had that advertisement, go with a buddy, be all you can be, and all that good stuff. So I went to the recruiter, and I signed up. And this was in 1975, so the Vietnam War was about over, and I just wanted to get out of there. I figured I'd go see the world. And I went and I put my enlistment papers in, and when I took the physical, I passed that. Took the written test, I passed that. And then it came time to go back to the recruiter to get my date. Well, when I show at the recruiter's office, he tells me, I'm sorry, Mr. Machiavello, we just got your records back from the Juvenile Department of Justice, and we know you just came out of doing 18 months, and we don't think you're Army material. And I meant this with all the sincerity I could muster up. I said, excuse me, but you want people to go over there and kill people, right? And he goes, basically, yeah. And I go, well, send me. You don't even got to train me. Just send me. To which he properly told me I had to leave his office, and I did. And so I figured I'd go find a job. You know what? I was going to go back to high school and finish, because in this reform school, I'm no dummy, so in reform school I could do two grades at the same time. I was doing the 11th and 12th grade at the same time and getting good averages. But it was time to go. I decided to leave. They asked me to stay another 6 months. I said, not on your butt. I ain't doing it. So I left, and so I decided, let me go back to high school in Brooklyn. And so I decided, after the Army rejected me, to try to get back into high school so I could just get a high school diploma. And when I got there, they said, the Board of Education works differently, Mr. Machiavello. First, you're going to have to come here and complete the 11th grade. Then you have to come back the year after and finish the 12th grade. Now, I don't know about you, but when you're 17 years old and you think about all the time you're going to have to do to finish high school, I thought I'd be 35 by the time I get out of high school. So I said, I might as well just go get me a job. So I decided to go get me a job. The next morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, I get up from my mom's house, I have a cup of coffee, I walk over to the bodega, to the grocery store, and I figure I'm going to pick up the Daily News. It's got a big, large want ad section in it, and I'm going to start looking through the want ads. And as I went into the grocery store, I looked through the windows of the double-pane window refrigerator, and I could see this quart of Budweiser sitting up there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I said, Now, only an alcoholic would think like this. I got to sit on that corner and read through these want ads. You know, I don't think having a beer would hurt me if I do that and go looking through these want ads and, you know. So I did that. I decided to get me a quart of beer, sit on the corner on the doctor's stoop where we always hung out, and started going through the want ads. Well, it's a thick section in New York back then in the Daily News. So I finished that quart and I got me the second quart. I said, well, I ain't done. Might as well get another quart. So I got me another quart. Then I finished that one and I got to a third quart. Now, this is only about 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the morning. By the time I finished that, halfway through that third quart, my mind said, Angel, you know what? You're 17 years old. You got the rest of your life ahead of you. Just go ahead and get drunk today. You can go look for a job tomorrow. And that's what I proceeded to do. I got drunk that day. The next morning, I woke up, 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to go look for a job. went to that same store, got that paper, looked in that refrigerator, that beer called my name again, and I did it again. And this went on for days. Now, eventually, I did get a job, because the beer kept telling me, wait till you're 17, you got the rest of your life. I finally got my first job at the age of 26. Between the ages of 17 and 26, I became what is known as this, on the streets of New York, as an entrepreneur. I got into the small auto parts business. If you needed a battery, a tire, a bumper, you came and you saw me. I got into the wholesale distribution business, you know, and that got me in a lot of trouble because I happened to use more product than I was willing to sell. And I got into the small appliance business. If you needed a camera, a stereo, a camcorder, whatever, you came and you saw me. Now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the love of my life. Nothing I love more than Alcoholics Anonymous. But there were some drugs and other substances in my life. And that's the only thing I'm going to say about that. I used these other substances along with alcohol. There was no time that I didn't have alcohol in my system first. Because I was the kind of alcoholic, I would have to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, have me a half a pint of rum, so it could give me the courage to do whatever I had to do to go get the money I needed for these other substances. And my life went straight downhill. You know, I started getting in trouble. Now, remember, I got out of school at 17. By the age of 21, I was, I had a little problem with the court system. And what happened was I had done an armed robbery, and I got arrested for it. And in New York, between the ages of 16 and 21, you used to fall into what is known as a youthful offender. And since I hadn't gotten arrested since I was before 16, because I was in reform school, and I hadn't got caught for anything else since I'd been out, we made a deal, and I ended up going to my first treatment center at the age of 19. Now, this treatment center had nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of those therapeutic communities, and what they did was give you bald heads and make you wear signs and make you do all kind of crazy stuff like sweep the sun off the roof. It's amazing how you can sweep that sun off the roof. And stuff. I cleaned the toilet with the toothbrush and the shower with the toothbrush. And I walked into that place, and I thought they were crazier than me. But I always thought I had an angle on everything, and I remember thinking, well, they told me I have to be in a drug program, so I grabbed all my little court papers after 30 days in that treatment center and said, I'm out of here. And I walked over to Dr. Capel's methadone maintenance clinic, and I showed them my court papers and said, look, man, and they looked at my tracks and they said, yep, you're an addict, and yeah, the court says you got to be on a program. I got on that program and I beat the system, or so I thought. My life didn't get any better from there. Then it was a constant in and out. My family would have nothing to do with me. I was sleeping in abandoned buildings and in the streets most of the time, or in an abandoned car, wherever. And sleeping in New York, when you're sleeping on those rooftops in the middle of January and that wind comes under that crack of that door, woo, you can feel it. And but that was the life I was choosing to live. And I met a girl around this time, and you know, I'm the typical picture you see in the movies. When you see a movie about New York junkies, they're sitting on the corner, drinking beer, hanging out, trying to figure out how they're going to make some money. You know, you don't bathe, you don't care. You're living in the abandoned buildings. And, you know, who would think any woman would get close to anything like that, you know? Well, I got to tell you, there's plenty. It must have been my charming personality. I don't know. But I remember seeing this girl walking down the sidewalk towards my sister's house, and we did the typical thing, you know, hey, mommy, whistled at her, yelled at her. And like, she kept walking, not paying us no attention, but she ducked into my sister's house, and I was the only one that seen that. And I got to tell you another thing about me, just so y'all know. I ain't never dated a woman who drank the drug until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was one of those selfish people, man. I seen what happened to my buds who dated girls who drank the drugs, you know. Half their stuff was gone. I wasn't sharing mine with nobody. You can forget that. This is my stuff. You ain't touching it. I ain't going to prison for you. No. I had this crush on this one girl who I used to see walk up and down the street of Brooklyn all the time. Finest Spanish girl I ever seen. And one day I'm in one of those, I don't know how to explain it, but we used to call them shooting galleries, and I'm doing my business, and I looked up, and there she was doing her business, and it was like a big knot created in my stomach. So all of a sudden, she became the ugliest thing in the world, because I seen her do the same things I was doing. Isn't that ironic? But I met this girl, and she started having my kids, and I decided to go try to get myself some help. Damn, I gotta get on drunk. And so I decided to go to a Pentecostal treatment center. And I remember I walked into this place, and it was in South Jersey, and they said, now by this time I'm smoking, drinking, I'm doing other substances, and I'm in a real bad space. And I go to this treatment center in South Jersey, it was called, a place called Faith Farm. And I get there, and I remember thinking, well, they'll detox me, they'll cut me cigarettes loose a little bit at a time. And the minister walks up to me and throws me a 2-pound bag of sour ball candies and says, here, we're going to pray for you, and you can't smoke, no drinking, no other substances. We're just going to pray for you. And I had to detox like that, and I said, man, they're crazy. But after a while, I felt better. And it was like 3 months later, I felt so spiritual, like we often do. We get spiritual. That I had decided that what I needed to do was grab my buddy who was from the Bronx, and we were going to go back to New York. And we talked to over with the minister, and we said, God told us, because that's what we felt, God told us we need to go get our rest of our friends saved. So we're going to go to Brooklyn, and I'm going to get my friends to go to church with me, and he's going to go to the Bronx, and he's going to get his friends to go to church with them, and then we're all going to get together and go visit each other's churches, and we're going to bring all these guys, my friends and his friends that are junkies and winos, bring them to church, and we're all going to get sober. And the minister said, I don't think God told you that. But I wasn't there legally, I mean through the court system, so I could leave whenever I wanted to. But I insisted that that's what God told me. And so we started hitchhiking from that place in South Jersey because we had no money. And a couple of guys picked us up. And when we got off their truck, they let us go in the back of the pickup truck. And when we got off the truck, one of them said to me, you guys got any money? I said, no, man, we're broke. We just left this treatment center. We ain't got no money. We're trying to get to Brooklyn, New York, Manhattan, one of those. And he says, well, here. And he goes into his wallet, gives me $5. The other guy goes in his wallet and gives the other guy who was with me $5. And my friend goes, man, we could just hop on the bus with this money from right here and get to New York in no time. But I seen the light, you know, and it was shining. It was right above the throughway, and it was blinking. I've been without nothing for 3 months, but that light was blinking as bright as day, you know, and there it was, liquors. And I said, I don't know about you, but I'm going to go get me a half a pint of rum. This was back in the day when it was not as expensive as it is today. And a pack of Newports. And by the time I got to Brooklyn, I was back on my way looking for those substances that I like to use so much. By that time, I had gotten a second daughter who, thank God for the state of New York and the great enablers they are, because they supported them. I didn't. I was never a father to my kids. Never. All I could think about was drinking and drugging. One of my daughters died during the time I was in one of those other treatment centers. And when they told me, the only thing I could think about was, my friends will feel sorry for me. I'll go back to Brooklyn. I'll go to bury her. And they're all going to get me high because they're going to feel sorry for me. And I'm going to get all the liquor and drugs that I want. And that's where liquor took me. By the age of 26, they decided I needed to get out of New York because either I was going to be killed, kill someone, die of an overdose, or end the rest of my life in the penitentiary. So they shipped me down here to my sister's house, and I remember on the plane thinking, okay, drugs is my problem. And this is on the plane before I even landed in Orlando. I'm thinking, drugs is my problem, I just won't do drugs anymore, but I could drink. And I've forgotten that I gotten up every morning at 7:00 in the morning. The first thing I did was get me half a pint of rum, wine, whatever I could afford at the time. And so I got down here, and that's where my first job came to take place. Because down here, I saw, man, you know, you got to work down here. It ain't like New York. The streets ain't paved to go down here. In New York, you can find your money on the streets. Down here, they want you to work and stuff. So I started applying at jobs, and I got me my first job at Howard Johnson's by the New York, by the Florida Turnpike over by St. Cloud, between St. Cloud and Kissimmee. And every day I would get me a half a pint at the ABC that was right next door of rum and a six pack of beer just to take me over that bridge to go home over Simpson Road. And then, because I was living in Bonaventura Lakes, then I would get me another 12 pack at the farm store and stop at the liquor store and get me a pint of VO or something like that. And that was my routine. Like I said, that was the first job I ever had. That lasted me any amount of time. I think I lasted a month in that job. The next 4 years, I was in and out of jobs. I must have had every job you could think of in Kissimmee. I must have worked in every one of those restaurants and stuff. I was mainly a dishwasher and stuff. And my life was going nowhere fast. I met another girl. She had another one, two more of my kids, and she got tired of it, and she kicked me out because she didn't drink or drug either. And here I was. Not that I did any more drugs down here, but I was constantly drunk, couldn't keep a job, and kept getting kicked out of apartment complexes. And back in those days, it was good because you could move into an apartment complex, pay your first month's rent, and pay the security deposit, and then not pay for 3 months because it took that long to get you out. So every 4 or 5 months we were moving, and I had that under the, I knew how to do that. And she got tired of that. And so I decided, well, she decided for me that we couldn't live together, and I was back on the streets down here, and I ended up going to the Salvation Army. And the Salvation Army said, well, we'll take you in. We know you're looking for help. And I really wasn't done yet. And they said, we're going to give you this thing called interviews. And we're going to keep you inside for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And you can't leave for the first 3 weeks. And once you take this interviews, you cannot drink on it because it will kill you. So I did that. I started taking the interviews. And after 3 weeks, let me go home for a day on pass. So I went to my sister's house, and my ex-girlfriend with my other two daughters was there. And I told her, you know, and because alcoholics are a strange breed, you know, I was there a hot 3 weeks. I was eating three squares of meal a day, which I wasn't used to. And I was working out with the weight, you know, maybe, look at me, I'm 5 pounds here, you know. But I thought I looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm going like this in the mirror. And I said, look at me, I haven't drank, I'm not going to drink no more, I'm working out, life is good. And I sweet-talked her, and we hooked up that afternoon, and then after we were done, I went over to take a walk. I needed a walk. I've been locked up three weeks. I need to see what's going on. And right there on 436, over by where the old Goodings was, there was a ABC liquor store or something down there. And as I'm walking by it, the thought entered my mind. They said I could die on this antabuse. They said it would kill me if I drank on it. But how do I know they're not lying to me? So, like the good alcoholic, I walked in, grabbed me a pint of beer, 2 miniatures of VO, and I sucked down that half a pint of VO and drank the beer. All of a sudden, my ass felt like they were standing straight on edge, you know, and from curly hair like mine, that's a feat to do. But it felt like my hair was standing straight on edge, my face got real red, and I remember thinking, I can handle this. And I kept right on drinking. I was staying at that Salvation Army. I would sneak out and go to the ABC lounge. I mean, to the ABC store and get me a beer all the time. And I would walk back into the place and they go, man, your face is red. Are you all right? Oh, yeah, you know how we Puerto Ricans are. We tan easily. I was out in the sun. Yeah, no big deal. And they believed that. Well, I got kicked out of there after a couple of times and my life was done. I was ruined, you know, and I didn't know how to stop. I'm sleeping on the streets of Orlando. I don't bathe. I'm living mainly over by Michigan and Fern Creek. The only thing I could do now, I couldn't even steal anymore. I just didn't have the energy. The only thing I could do was bum money on Michigan Street, usually bumming from people walking by or whatever. And I remember I walked November 13th, 1988. I got up out of one of those apartment buildings over by the Armory on Fern Creek. and I had been sleeping on the top floor. And I remember I hadn't bathed for a while, and I walked out the door, and I started heading to the store. I think maybe I had a dollar in my pocket. I was going to get me a half a pint of something to calm my nerves. And as I got to the armory, my legs gave out on me. Now, I was stone cold sober. I wasn't drunk, but my legs just would not carry me no more. And right there at that moment, I said, God, if there is a God, please help me. I can't do this no more. From that day on, I haven't had a drink. I walked into detox for the last time. I didn't know it was the last time. And I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the guys who brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me were guys who've been in a state called the domiciliary. These guys had only been sober 2 and 3 months, but they told my story. And when they told my story, I identified and I said, I got to go to that place because my life was done. As far as I knew, I had nothing to live for. I had no hope when I got here. There was nothing, nothing. I was a shell of a man with nothing in it. And I walked into that treatment center, and all they talked about was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. And they started guiding us through the 12 principles in this book. And they started telling us about getting a power greater than yourself. And they started telling us about working these steps. And they started telling us about getting sponsors. And I remember I went to a meeting when they told me to find a sponsor that had what you want. I remember I went to a meeting in the South Orlando group at that time, and I'm just sitting out there smoking a cigarette before the meeting, and here rolls in this big caddy. And here comes steps this guy out, and he's got all this fine gold jewelry on his neck, and he's got diamonds. He's got a Rolex. I could spot a Rolex 3 bar stools down. And I said to myself, he's got what I want. So I asked that gentleman to sponsor me, and he told me he didn't have the time, and I think that was a gift from God. Because that's not what they were talking about. I stayed in this treatment center was supposed to be for a year, and I stayed in there for 2 years. There was always something happening to me the way I wanted. I was ready to go. God had some reason for not letting it happen. I ended up staying there 2 years, and at 2 years sobriety, I started going to different meetings, and one of the meetings I went to was this meeting that I met my sponsor, who passed away a couple of years ago, who's the only man that I tell you, man, I never loved a man till I met this man. I never loved any man more, including my dad, than I loved that man. My sponsor, his name was Bill Oakley, and he'd give me permission to use his name when he was alive, so I know you don't care now. And Bill Oakley started taking me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started guiding me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember Bill wasn't a man of many words. I remember I was complaining because the only job I could find at one time was flipping burgers at Wendy's for $4.25 an hour. And you know how alcoholics get when you're 2.5 years sober. You know, you should be a CEO of a major corporation. And that's what I thought. You know, I should be a banker or something. You know, I've been, for God's sakes, I've been sober 2.5 years. CEO sounds good with GED, you know, because that's the only thing I had. You know, I wanted to be a CEO and with a GED diploma. And I remember Bill looking at me and just shaking his head and going, can't start where you ain't. And those were the kind of times that were very spiritual between me and Bill, because he would say these one-liners and I would want to choke him through the neck, but I knew he was right. And he started guiding me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life started to change, and it started to get better, and things got different. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is so outlined that we gotta get rid of the old way of thinking and go on to a new. And my way of thinking before I got into Alcoholics Anonymous was just totally whacked, you know? And when we start working on those, we talk about working on character defects. The only ones I ever worked on that I could remember was the stealing. Bill made it real simple. Angel, it ain't yours. Don't take it. Wow, what a concept. Is that how that goes, you know? The rest of it has been constant improvement through working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step was real easy for me. It was that, you know, I knew my life was unmanageable. I believe I took the first 3 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on that corner on First Creek in Michigan, November 13, 1988. I was done. I knew I couldn't drink. I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew there might be a power out there greater than me. And so I was willing to turn my will and my life over to that power. That was it. I took the 3 steps. But as luck would have it, I had to start working a 4th and a 5th and the rest of these steps. In the 4th step, I remember thinking, wow, this is the trip, because I get to say who I'm mad at, right? And I start writing who I'm mad at. And I was mad at everybody, because that ain't like me. And if I ain't like me, there's no reason for me to like you. And so I started naming people, and then telling them why I was mad at them. And then Bill would have to come into that part and then point things. Well, let's go see. And I like to tell my sponsors today, and they hate this, because I always tell them, so our troubles are over our own making, huh? And I couldn't see that at first, but today I know that all my troubles are of my own making. If I try to follow the dictates of the God of my understanding, if I try to do everything according to the God of my understanding today, I would have any problems. But the thing is, I got this built-in forgetter, and I think my way just might be a little better. It's like when I was getting ready to go to college. I was going to Valencia Community College, and I was become a therapist, because the people in that treatment center said, man, Angel, you'd be a great therapist. You've been through a lot of things in your life. You lived in the streets of New York. You're a hellraiser, and you're changing your life. And we think you'd be a good counselor to become a therapist and help other alcoholic and drug addicts. I said, okay, that sounds good. And I remember I used to go to that Valencia Community College West Campus, and I used to sit in the dining room, and this is the problem with alcoholics. Look where we get ourselves. We forgot where God brought us from, but we want to say where we want to take the credit. And I started taking the credit. Look what I have done. If my friends in Brooklyn could see me now, wow, I'm going to college. And I could see God looking down on me going, Angel, you ain't done jack, man. I got it. I did it all for you, man. Look up. And all these things. And I remember sitting there, and another thing I like to do is daydream. I used to daydream like a madman. And I remember sitting back there, wow, my friends could see me now. I'm going to be the best therapist ever. I'm going to write books, and they're going to put me on Oprah and Geraldo. And man, I just went there, you know? And I really felt that. And something happened in my life at that time where I couldn't go. And that's where I started working for $4.25 an hour, flipping burgers. And I believe in the power of prayer. And somebody told me, just go put applications everywhere. You need to get a job. And so I remember going to Wendy's that day, and I had the application filled out. And before I went in, I remember praying, oh, God, please, God, don't let me get this job, right? I walk in with the application. I gave it to the manager. The only words he ever said after he looked at it, he goes, can you start tomorrow? And I'm going, oh my God. And I was so embarrassed. I was so embarrassed that I had to work at Wendy's. You know, God, if somebody from AA comes in when I got to take out the trash, what will I do, you know? What an embarrassment. You mean you actually got a job, Angel? No, they're going to see me with the funny hat and the funny shirt, and that's all I could think about. And Bill used to say, you're just going to have to walk through this. And you know, I ended up loving that job after a while, because I started working the steps and looking at my part in a lot of different things. And I ended up becoming a manager of that place. And then I worked that intergroup for a while. And all along, the steps have been guiding me. And whenever I look back in the rearview mirror of my sobriety, I could always tell where God had a plan all along. Whatever seemed the worst thing that can happen to me, God always had that plan in back. Because I could not see things. I see things in the natural world. The God of my understanding works in the spiritual world. You can't see the stuff he's doing. And you never know where he's taking you until 10 years later, maybe, when you look back and go, oh, wow, is that what happened? And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that. I've been through some devastating things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I lost custody of my daughters at one time. I had to put them in HRS custody and foster care, because it was the best thing for them at that time, and not what was best for me. And I remember I used to cry over that situation. And I remember one day, I cried for about 3 or 4 months over that situation. And I thought I was going to go crazy, because we get to a point where we're not accepting what God has given us and accepting life on life's terms. And I was at that point. And I couldn't understand why I had to work flipping burgers at $4.25 an hour. I couldn't understand why my daughters had to be in foster care. I couldn't understand why HRS, because In a matter of 2 weeks, all these things happened. I had to quit college and forget about being on Oprah and Geraldo. I had to put my daughters in foster care. I had to get me a job, and the only one I could find was making that $4.25 an hour. And IRS called me and said, "We want some of that money you stole from us when you was before you got sober." So I needed to get some of that, or they were going to put me in jail. And the HRS kindly let me know that I still had a daughter in New York, and they would want their $5,000 or I was going to jail. And for 3 months, I had to carry that, because it all happened within 2 weeks. And I would go to meetings. I would go to ODAT, to the 11-step meeting, and people say the dumbest things at meetings, don't they? Sometimes they do. I think they do. I'm crying and sharing and giving my heart out there, putting it out there, and people say stupid things like, "Keep coming back," and I'm like, "What?" You know, I don't want to hear that. Or, "This too shall pass." The little old ladies love that one. "This too shall pass." You know, I want to kill people. But I paid attention, and I did keep coming back. And I knew that there was changes coming in my life. And, you know, out of all those things that happened to me with those kids and everything else, and the HRS and IRS, my life turned out better than I ever thought possible. My daughters ended up staying with their aunt in Kissimmee, sleeping on water beds, with a pool in the backyard, all the toys they could ever want in their lives. Things that I could have not given them at the time. IRS is the only people I know that you don't have to be in the 12-step program. They make you make an amends. And I finally paid that amends off. You know, and that job that ended up for 25 an hour, I ended up managing and training managers for them. And that, you know, the HRS, now I've never heard this done before for child support, and I haven't heard it happen since. But when I went to court, the judge just said, "Okay, Mr. Machiavello, we're going to forget about the $5,000. We just want you to stop paying child support from here on in. Don't worry about back child support payments." And they cleared my slate. And I've never heard that done since or before me. And that's a miracle of God. And, you know, I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous going now on 22 years, and my life has changed. But it hasn't changed just because I show up and go to meetings. It hasn't changed because I sit next to somebody who has long-term sobriety. It's changed because I've implemented the steps in my daily living. And in today's meeting at 10 a.m. this morning, we were discussing something out of the Big Book, and a line hit me. And I guess I'm supposed to share that line with somebody here. And it's just this simple. Yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And to me, that line meant the world today, because I remember what that was like. See, reconstruction, anybody that knows about construction, we have construction where you begin from new. Reconstruction comes from taking what's there and try to take what's bad out of it, sometimes just leaving the four shells, the four building, the four walls, and reconstructing the inside. And that's what the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous did for me. It reconstructed my life. Now, the great deal about that is you got to have an architect, because all construction projects have an architect. And the architect in my reconstruction process was God. Then you got to have a general contractor. The general contractor in my life at that time was Bill Oakley, or, you know, my sponsor, who knew how to read the blueprint. Ah, yeah, the blueprint. The blueprint comes directly from the architect, which to me is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and working through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where the process began. And that's what happened to me. My whole life since I've been here, November 13, 1988, has been a reconstruction project. Because I won't be done until the shells close in and I'm put in the ground. That's when the reconstruction is over. Until then, I got to find ways and ask God to guide me in the direction where I can develop spiritually. What happens in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of times is people come into AA, they may even believe that there's an architect. They may even get themselves a general contractor. They may even work some of these steps and try some of this stuff. But then sometimes they want to disregard the blueprint of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I call the Big Book. They disregard those blueprints, and they think they got a better way. And when they do that, stuff starts going bad. the shell stopped caving in, the building is not done right, the beams are not properly set in place. And when they do that, they fail. So with me, I always got to remember, God is at my architect. You know, my sponsor right now, who's Jack, he is my construction contractor. The blueprints are the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I got to do is follow what it says there, and my life will continue to change for the better. There are difficult times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going through a difficult stage right now. But I know God's always the final architect. You know? And he's seen me walk through these things like with my daughters before. And my jobs. And marriage. And divorce. And he's seen me walk through all that. And I've never come out worse than what I went in. Something better has always come along. And so my spiritual life, I feel, is great right now. My emotional life is great. And my mental life, well, some of y'all might criticize me, you know, some of you got your own opinion on that one, but I think I'm all right. That's okay. And the physical stuff I'm going through, I believe God has an answer to that. And all I got to do is keep trusting in Him. And sometimes it takes, the longer you hear, the harder it is to trust the God of your understanding. Because even though I've seen Him work miracles in my life before, sometimes I forget to look in the rearview mirror. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it's done for me. I love the person who I become. And here comes some of my people from my home group. Now, how I'm about to say, but I love this. See, before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't like me. I didn't like you. I didn't like anybody. But today, I look at myself in the mirror and I go, damn! Look at you, boy! You're intelligent. You're handsome. You're kind. You're loving. You're caring. You're understanding. You're emotionally there for other people. You're a blessing in other people's lives. And some of y'all say, well, that sounds conceited, Angel. No, it's not conceited. It's knowing that the process and what God has done in my life has made me a totally different man that I can love today. I love me so much, I wish there was more of me to go around. But that only comes from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to close with this, because I just looked back across Julie and I got to say this. One time Julie was sharing in the meeting, and she... there's about 10 people before me because we go around the room at Central. And she said, I love the woman AA has made me. I love who I am today. And I remember thinking, and it got to me, and I go, I agree with Julie. I like the woman AA has made her too. And I believe sobriety is about having fun. We're not a glum lot. And I went to the 50 pod last weekend. And I tell you what, for guys like me who've been around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 22 years, who have worked the steps, who think we got a basic grasp of this program, we can learn something from them young people. The enthusiasm and the energy that was exhibited by those young people brought joy to my heart. I felt like I was reborn. I think we have a place for everybody. And I think before we start discrediting people, we got to look within ourselves and find out, what are we doing for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? What are we doing for our sobriety? Are we giving into the program, or are we just taking? We need to know where our place is. And I know my place is to be of guidance and help to others that come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you know what? I may not be all there, but that's why I'm all here. Because this is the only life I got. And I want to thank you and this home group for inviting me to speak here. And if there's any newcomer who just walked into this meeting or who's never been to an AA meeting, I believe in the power of God. I believe in the power of prayer. I believe in the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the Big Book. And if God can do it for me, a wino junkie, to turn a wino junkie to become a productive member of society, He can do it for you. And thank you for letting me share my story.